We're really excited to be partnering with the UIS Music Department and Yona, who has brought this to us today. So without further ado, I'll let Yona introduce everybody and start.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to the Suggs Performance Studio here at WUIS. I'm Yona Stamatis, Assistant Professor of Ethnomusicology. And we are delighted to have with us in the studio today three exceptional musicians. Maestro Alistair Willis, who is the music director and conductor of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, Sandeep Das, virtuoso tabla player, and Dinuk Wadaratne, composer, conductor, pianist, and many other things. So we have gathered here for a conversation about the upcoming concert by the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, titled Beethoven Meets the Silk Road. The concert will take place on Saturday, October 11th at 7:30 p.m. in Sangamon Auditorium here on campus. For more information about that concert, you can visit www.ilsymphony.org. So it is so interesting to have these three musicians with us for a conversation today who are masters of their art, but also masters of musical communication. Each in his own way uses music as a tool to challenge deeply ingrained understandings of self and other, to transgress cultural or national boundaries. And each uses music to offer solutions about how to deal with the conflicting and pervasive narratives of nationalism, multiculturalism, and globalization. And this concert in particular, I think, speaks to many of those issues. So Alistair, perhaps you can begin and just tell us a bit about what audiences can expect to hear on this concert, Beethoven Meets the Silk Road.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Yona, and to be with this distinguished company with you. We've got a world concert. We've got a great piece by a great composer who's been dead for over 200 years. No, almost 200 years. And Ludwig van Beethoven, I mean, one of the greatest classical composers ever, his Symphony No. 3. You know, at the end of his life, he was asked, which is your favorite symphony that you wrote? Without hesitating, he said the Third Symphony. So that's how highly and he wrote some great stuff. to pair that, in the first half, we have some world music by two other great composers, one of them who's with us right now. I wish Beethoven was alive so that I could ask him some questions.
Me too.
Unfortunately, when I work with living composers, you're still alive?
Yes.
Great. I can ask the questions, and we have a connection, we have a communication, and it's really great. This first half is more Silk Road than the Beethoven Symphony, as you would imagine. And my bigger picture, which we'll talk a bit more in a minute, might be to have the whole Silk Road here, doing a residency in central Illinois for a week or so, sometime in a few years. With that idea, that's my dream, how to get there. That's a big ticket, a very expensive ticket, and if we can involve the communities, the universities in Bloomington as well, and we can come and do things like this in our community and engage as many people as possible, I think we're going to stand a chance of having a very impactful week. But to get there, to get the juices flowing, which are flowing right now in this room, I can see them and feel them, why not have individual members of the Silk Road come and perform with the Illinois Symphony? They're all soloists in their own right. And as you know, the Silk Road Ensemble, which Sandeep can say a bit more about, is the brainchild of a cellist called Yo-Yo Ma. You might have heard of him. And the purpose is really to cross cultures through music. And we're doing that in this concert this week, this weekend, with Beethoven, with Dinuk's piece, and with another Silk Road composer who's not here today, Colin Jacobson. So you're going to have an East meets West fusion concert of global music that is really reaching out, as you said, Yona, to every corner of our globe and our community.
And I think Dinuk is perhaps the epitome of the global composer. I think you've lived in more cities than I can probably name. could you tell us a little bit about your background and then also your compositional, your take, your style?
Sure. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I was really moved by your introduction. Thank you. About what you said about our motives for being here. That's you captured it perfectly. I'm Sri Lankan by birth. I left Sri Lanka when I was three or four, and I grew up in the Middle East in Dubai. And that actually had quite a profound impact on my my music. Just being around, just essentially having a Western, completely Western classical training in a Middle Eastern country where, you know, in the evenings you could listen to Indian music or Arabic music. And then I did my undergrad in the UK in Manchester. And then I moved to New York to study there, which is where I met Yona. And then I moved to Canada. And I do love Canada. I live in Toronto at the moment, and it's one of the most multicultural cities in the world. And I feel very at home musically there, I have to say, because I meet musicians from all over the place. And I would say, if I had to try and define my music at the moment, it's preoccupied with two things, and one is where improvisation meets the preconceived, if you like. So there's and that very much comes from you know, non-Western styles, which are primarily about improvisation, and yet, you know, improvisation when it sounds really great is when it is inevitable, when it sounds like it's been written down. And great music that's been written down, like the Eroica, sounds best when it sounds almost like it's been improvised, and yet you knew that it was preconceived. So there's this wonderful duality between those two things. And I would say the other thing is where the cultures meet in the music, and how you can marry, say, a tabla with a Western symphony orchestra and make those things work.
I think that's really interesting when you're thinking about the composer and sort of relinquishing a little control over the music and allowing the performer to have some sort of improvisatory freedom as they're going, which is, I think, can be quite rare.
Mm-hmm.
I think. And last but not least, perhaps most of all, Sandeep Das, will you tell us a bit about where you come from?
Well, I grew up in India, in a small city called Patna. Learned my instrument here is called tabla, which is from the northern part of India. It's a traditionally a classical drum for northern Indian classical music. I learned it in a city called Varanasi or Banaras by living with my guru for 12 years. Then I moved to New Delhi and started. My debut concert was when I was 15 years with a very famous sitarist, almost like the cellist that you mentioned, Ravi Shankar. So I played with him when I was 15. And I started traveling the world first. Came to the US in 1990, and I would travel, play Indian classical music, and go back home. I would say one of the hugest influences in my life, which has changed me not only as a musician but as a human being, came when I was asked to play with Yo-Yo Ma and the New York Philharmonic, which happened in the year 2000. And that is when I first got a glimpse beyond the wall. You know, I almost feel that I was like, I got a peep in there and fell in love with the other side of the wall. And slowly, as my journey has taken me around, I feel there is no wall. It's what we create and say, this is Indian music. That's for us, all that is not Indian is Western classical. You know, so there is. So how do you explain that? So that's been an interesting experience from my side, and I moved to Boston. So now I live in Boston a year and a half. So I moved there with my family. And from being a traditional Indian classical musician who didn't know who Yo-Yo Ma was or what this gentleman is doing with his back towards the audience, I think I've come a long way. I think my journey has been very interesting, that now at least I'm on the right side of this gentleman and I can see his facial expressions and the small wooden thing that he has in his hand. So,
yeah, what is that?
And also, you know, why I'm sharing this is that will give you an idea of, though I had played at the Lincoln Center, Royal Albert Hall, Carnegie, before I met Yo-Yo, I really didn't know that, of course, I didn't know who Yo-Yo Ma was, and to me, the cello was just a bigger violin. So that's how different a world I come from. And yet, once I was able to make that connection, I'm almost addicted, you know. And now I'm playing with orchestras, I'm playing with string quartets, and what Dinuk was saying, basically, it's about there is no difference. It's about finding the me in you, and for you to find the me, you in me, and everything else just falls in place very, very naturally. So that's my story.
Wonderful. I think one of the elements that makes this concerto for tabla and orchestra by Dunuk such a work of genius is how it really marries Western classical music, but keeps also elements of mm-hmm. Hindustani classical music and traditional tabla technique. If you want to speak perhaps a little bit to that, and also maybe even before that, if you want to show us just a bit, you know, what a student's first lesson might be like on the tabla, how we can start to understand the instrument so that we can see then how Dunuk has worked these elements so brilliantly mm-hmm. into the concerto.
Okay, I can play something first.
You know, I met Dunuk, which year was that, 2006 or 2005?
2004.
And he wrote a piece for piano, tabla, and strings. And somehow, then I never met him again. You know, it's only this year that
we reconnected.
Yeah, we reconnected. You know, I asked a violinist friend of mine, and I said, you know, do you remember the Sri Lankan composer? He says, yeah. I said, I really loved what he had done. Do you know where he is now? And
he said, I saw him a week ago at a bar in Toronto.
He said, I saw him a week back, and actually I have shared your phone number with him, and he's going to get in touch with you. And here we are playing his piece. So this is the tabla. Some basic sounds are ta. It's an incredible drum. You know, we have a sound that can be replicated. It almost feels that this instrument has a tongue. So whatever I say can be spoken back by the instrument. So if I say, dheek dhinna, tirik dhinna, wait, that's not the first lesson.
This was the fourth. So I demonstrated the first lesson in Yona's class yesterday, and I think she loves it. So now that she's so the first lesson that any child would learn is you all want to count with me quickly to 16? Yeah, let's do that. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, no clap on the ninth. 13, 14, 15, 16. First lesson. Dha, dha, te, te. Dha, dha, tin, na. Ta, ta, te, te. Da da din na. This is the only fixed part.
Next time.
Thanks.
Wow.
You can tell why you would love to write for an instrument like that. Yeah. And a musician like that. So. Yeah.
And improvisation as well. In
that
piece.
I think what Dinuk
actually,
was
no,
saying
no,
that
you.
Improvisation shouldn't sound as if it doesn't belong, and vice versa. So what I did, the basic subject That's what your guru teaches you. So, da, da, te, te, da, da, te, na. So there are some rules that I cannot use any other element, but I can play around with those particular sounds in a fixed composition. But what I do with those sounds within the time frame of a rhythm cycle is my creation, is my ability, is how much time I have devoted. So in a way, I loved what you said, that improvisation should almost seem that it's written down. So it might seem it's all written down, but it's probably written down in my head, you know, in my brain by years of practice.
But what about improvisation in your piece? Can you speak about that?
Actually, it's interesting that there isn't any improvisation per se in the piece, but it uses a lot of material that was born out of essentially a tradition that has a lot of improvisation, a tradition that has a repertoire for instance, kaidas, which a kaida is a kind of cyclic Indian form where the performer would reflect his or her own improvisational magic or invention. But it has a logic that is so strong that it's written down. Mm-hmm. So there is this there's always this duality between what is written down and what is improvised. So all of the material usually comes out of stuff like that.
Do you send him a score? Because I know he learns.
Yeah, absolutely. And the tabla bowls, which are the syllables that he would use, are actually I wrote them all down. So he was able to learn the compositions from the bowls. And in a sense,
wait till you hear your piece if you recognize it anymore.
Oh, that, you have to be careful when someone's this good at improvising. Yeah. But in a sense, the piece is in three movements because that's a standard Western model. But the three movements, I took the opportunity to create three very different perspectives of the tabla. So from the end to the beginning, the last movement is the culmination of what would be in a standard tabla recital that Sandeep would do, let's say by himself, just accompanied by a time cycle, where at the end he would present, you know, the gems of his particular repertoire, compositions that he might be able to just maybe give us an example of later on, in this kind of high-speed exposition, this kind of virtuoso showcase. So I wanted to try and capture that. And then in the second movement, which is like your sort of classical slow movement, it's a perspective of the tabla as an accompanist in a non-classical Indian setting. So folk songs, light folk songs, which are about love and loss, for instance. And the ironic thing is it has this title from a Hausmann poem. So that's another thing. I just saw this line in a Hausmann poem and I went, that's it, that's the slow movement. it's this line from Hausmann, but it has an Indian time cycle. And then the first movement, I thought, well, okay, I've done the other two, Indian classical music and then light Indian folk music. I thought, well, why not the first movement about the perspective of the global nature of the tabla that has become popular in pop music and you just hear tabla samples even, not even live tabla players, in pop tracks. Drum and bass, techno by Nitin Sawhney and all of these composers. And so there's this marriage of Hindustani kaidas with drum and bass, hence the kit player. Mm-hmm. And it's just this notion of the tabla having such an incredibly rich sound that you can use it in so many contexts, movie soundtracks and everything. You could have different perspectives of the same instrument.
You know, speaking of the organization of the piece, as a composer, how do you sort of marry the cyclic perception of time that pervades in the traditional tabla tradition with the sort of teleological perception of time, let's say in a Beethoven symphony where you're progressing from the first note and you're trying to get to the end and you finished kind of a feeling?
Absolutely, that's a great question. In the two Western and Eastern perspectives are interesting. I tend to compare them a lot. I know in Indian music, correct me if I'm wrong, but people perceive time as either being cyclic or cadential. So for instance, if you look at all of the tabla compositions in the piece, they're either cyclic or cadential, right? The explosive ones have this cadential sound and the cyclic ones have this sort of hypnotic loop kind of thing. And then, and just from being a conductor, like for instance, conducting a Beethoven symphony, I really firmly believe the more I conduct classical music, that music generally falls into two categories. It's either groove based or not, you know. And there are great passages in Beethoven where he doesn't want you to mess with any sort of metronomic urgency. And then there are other passages where a rubato is necessary. And that's very interesting because you can't, I mean, I know there's a place in the concerto where it says absolutely no ritardando, because it comes at the climax of a traditional Indian composition, tabla composition, and I absolutely, and no tabla player would ever slow down. And behind him are like 60 musicians who in a classical context might just slow down. It's just so tempting. So I remember writing in block capitals, absolutely no rallentando. And that was an interesting cultural moment where you essentially have to, you know, explain to the different cultural context that this is something that we wouldn't play differently, you know. Mm-hmm. I hope that answers your question. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, this next question really could be for anyone. In a traditional concert of Hindustani classical music, audiences are very, very knowledgeable of the tradition. They often understand how to count time cycles and so on and so forth. What do you hope or expect an American audience or Western audience could get out of this composition listening? How much do they need to know?
I think you don't really need to know anything. I hope. I think just the way a great, you know, like a great Kurosawa film should move everyone. If you have married the two cultures well and it communicates, I mean, this is something that Yo-Yo is about. He's always about, you know, what the, you know, he says, like, anyone can play to their friends and family. He says, but I'm interested in that guy at the back, in the back row, who doesn't care about what I'm doing. I want to reach him.
It's like being a professor.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think if you can solve those problems about, you know how a particular gesture will communicate and then the performer can execute that with the meaning of the composer's intention, that hopefully should work.
I also feel, you know, sometimes the best moments are when you're not trying to analyze something, because you know, sometimes even with an Indian classical music, if you know something, then you look or hear something with a completely different mindset. You're constantly analyzing. I feel the best moments are when you don't know something and just let the music either make you happy or you go back home saying, I didn't like it. So I agree with Dinok that they don't have to know anything. If Maestro Alistair.
Let's see if he agrees now. Do we have to know anything when we play?
Yeah, when we play, yes. But when we listen, no. I mean, you can. I mean, you can know all about Beethoven's history, how he just was struggling, beginning to struggle with his deafness, and then you can hear that struggle coming out in ways that if you didn't know that, you wouldn't know. But you'd still be able to enjoy the music. There's so many different levels to enjoy a piece on. And for your piece, there are so many levels. Just before Sandeep has even played a note, you're seeing a Western orchestra and an Indian percussion instrument. There, it's like, wait, that doesn't fit. That's unusual. I've never seen that before. Already you're merging the visual, and I'm already excited to understand what that's going to sound like, as well as just look like. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting. Just to go back, did you compose the concerto, third movement, second movement, first movement?
Portions of the first movement came first.
Ah, because yeah. Beethoven actually composed, we understand, the scholars understand, he composed the last movement first.
Oh, really?
And then from that he had to take the shape of the first three movements. So I was just thinking, what a great connection might have been. So.
Yeah, no, but definitely a non-linear way. That's usually how I compose. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you said no improvisation, yes, all of Sandeep's part is written out.
It's written out, but there's room for, I don't know how you describe it, embellishment.
I'll go back to my ignorance about anything other than Indian classical music. I have really bothered Yo-Yo with all sorts of stupid questions in the 16 years that I've known him. You know, like from the question to why is this man standing with his back towards us? So I'll answer this question a little differently. I asked him, it's like, if this is the New York Philharmonic, aren't they supposed to be like one of the best orchestras? He says, yes. Then I said, so, you know, why do they have to
have that music? If they have that music, why do they have to have the conductor to tell them how to play it? Aren't they supposed to? Yeah, it's like if you are the best, you are one of the best, you should be able to play that. Why do you need someone to tell you how to play it? So Yo-Yo's answer will help answer this. You know, it was beautiful. He gave me such a good answer. He says, well, you don't drive looking at the GPS, do you? Let me expand on that. He says, so the GPS tells you the best route to go from A to B. So that's what the score is telling you. But how you drive and reach from A to Z will always differ person to person. You know, how you drive your individual car. So that's what the score is there to help the musician understand, you know, what the composer wants you to do, how to reach from A to Z. But how you do that is your individuality, and that's where the maestro makes a difference to the same written music. And I feel, again, his music, though it's written down, will have a lot of me driving it.
Absolutely.
You know, and how I feel. Mm-hmm. I think one of your students asked yesterday that what's going on in your head while you are playing, you don't read music. And I think so, a combination of it all. And I must say that this gentleman here, you know, I have been very fortunate to have played with some of the best maestros of the biggest orchestras now in the last 15 years. I feel the most confident and relaxed when I have Alistair. Yes, because he has the sensibility to understand that I'm not necessarily, even though I have a piece of paper in front of me, I'm not necessarily reading it. It's just there for all of you to feel good. One less oddity that, oh, he doesn't even have music. Jokes apart, but I really, really mean it, that it's great for this city and for the orchestra to have someone like him. That when I first worked with him, I just went to him. I said, you know what? Can I talk to you? He says, yes. I made sure that on his score, he had absolutely clear marks where he had to look at me. And when not even looking at me would help me, because if he looked at me, I would just go. So the fact that he's here and he has the vision to, you know, bring weird musicians like me.
No.
If I was the community, I would be really grateful, because as a young musician, I tell all my students all the time that the sooner you open your world to what that Korean musician is doing or the Chinese musician is singing about, your life as a successful musician has a better chance. And the way we are getting closer, I think I go to Juilliard for master classes. I tell them that you could be the best violinist coming out of Juilliard, but please, the sooner you find out what others are doing who don't necessarily play your style of music, you'll have more fun. And people say Yo-Yo has more fun with the Silk Road Ensemble than he has ever, not officially, but just keep it in this room.
Let's keep it in this
delete
room.
Delete it from any recording. he even says that to us, that this is where he has fun, whereas everywhere else he's working. You know, and so I'm really grateful, Alistair, that you invited me. You liked the Nook's piece. When he got in touch with me, he says, we want to get you here. I sent the Nook's piece. So thanks to the community for supporting him, and thanks to you for getting us here. And your vision, I think, coming from an outside world, is the vision that I think I wish every orchestra had. So thanks to you.
You're so kind. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Sandeep. I must... if anything of what you said was true regarding me, then it must... I must also thank Yo-Yo for my conducting.
Absolutely.
With musicians of the Silk Road. Sandeep is a regular member of the Silk Road. He goes all the time. I have been on 5 or 6 tours in the last 16 years, so not often. When they call me to conduct, you got to know it's a really tricky piece, because they can usually put stuff together. They don't use a conductor. They are learning, you know, their GPS is just to figure it out themselves. And like a chamber music, like a chamber ensemble. So when they call me, you know it's got to be so hard that they just need some help. And working with musicians who obviously read music and is one thing, is my training, but those who don't, it's been a, I feel it's added another string to my bow as a conductor. I just want to make this point. I'm going to go back to the improvisation for one last time if I can. So He has some sort of freedom, but it's written down, as is the music of the orchestra. It's written down in the language.
That's completely
written But
down.
There are two or three moments where there's an oboe solo that says free. And there's a moment where the flutes are just, you know, written script. So that, I mean, that's it's improvised, if you will. And and so there are some moments. And I think that is very much a marriage of the two styles there coming. But of course, don't forget that in a classical concerto, the soloist would have a cadenza. And Mozart, Haydn, they would allow the soloist, hopefully, to make sense of the their own through line. And before they would do a trill, and the orchestra would come back in and end the movement. So what I find fascinating is that there's no specific cadenza per se in his part, and yet it sounds, it may sound like it's improvised, but it's written down, but it always makes sense. It always has a trajectory, a cyclic. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
It's very, very cool, this improvisation and not. So, and of course, if I can just make a connection with Beethoven, he wrote his last movement first, and the story goes that there was, his biggest rival was a guy called Daniel Steibelt. And Steibelt thought he was a better pianist, challenged Beethoven to a duel, so to speak, because remember Beethoven showing up in Vienna, he wasn't so much known as a composer, he was a pianist, that's how he made his living. Went to all the parties by the rich people, and he was competing with the same people for the same commissions and the same dollars, or no, whatever they had in Vienna, marks back then, and it wasn't euros, that's for sure. And it worked in against Steibelt, because Beethoven blew him out of the water. Steibelt went first, I think, and improvised on a theme that Beethoven had written. It made him so angry. Then played a piece of his own. So Beethoven got there. The cello part was still on the piano. He turned it upside down. He played it backwards, upside down. And then he improvised for 2 hours. 2 hours! And Steibelt had to leave town. So
it's like the Wild West.
It is like the Wild West, but no guns. And it's this bass line that he turned upside down that is part of the fourth movement that he started, and it goes through all this improvisation. For me, it's just as you said, there's no one set tempo for the whole movement, because I'm imagining the crazy man going quicker here, slower here, a little bit. It's not too noticeable. I'm not being completely revolutionary with it, but it has to have a sense of madness about it. I get the orchestra to play just a little wilder for a moment. So, I mean, Beethoven, he was a wild guy, classical, but he was breaking the rules too. So
I know what you mean, and when I said the boundary between the preconceived and the improvised, I didn't necessarily only mean improvised in the sense where you give people total freedom. I believe that there is a spectrum with every possible gradation in between. So for instance, even in Beethoven's music, you can get a sense of which passages have a more improvisatory quality, simply because he was such a great improviser himself, and which passages have a more sort of like, they're more like granite, you know, it's just like, okay, I've sculpted this and that's how it's gonna stay for 300 years, you know. So it's just knowing, as you say, like where you want the musicians to get a bit wilder, because that might, in a different context, have been improvised.
Yeah, right.
That kind of thing.
But there's one moment that is clearly written down, but the effect for us, just one I'm going to say, in your piece, which I absolutely love, I call it Shadows. I don't know what you call it, but the melody. Da dee dum bum bum bum. Approximately. He has about 9 different instruments play that, but slightly after. Someone plays it slightly slower, someone plays it slightly faster. And all these sounds, dum dum dim dum dum dim dum 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 dim dim dum. It's the overall effect. I can't really.
It is like a shadow.
And it's like I feel shadows coming in, and then the tablet just feels a moment, and it comes in again. But it sounds so free, but it is written down, so everyone knows where they are. We all line up at the very end.
It's actually the same melody. It's kind of like those effects where you in the Japanese ceremony. It's when you have all the bells, but they're attached to one chord. So you pull the chord, but because the bells are different sizes, they play the same thing, but because one is bigger, one will go slower, the other one will go faster.
Right.
So you get one ictus, but everything like ripples moving at different speeds. They just go at different speeds and blow up like that.
That kind of actually reminds me of the subdivisions you were talking to us about and your playing. I wonder, does this piece extend your techniques at all? Do you feel like you have to change the way you play a bit to play the concerto?
I feel, first of all, I think it's a very, very beautiful piece. You know, this is the second tabla concerto that I'm playing in my life. Mm-hmm. And I feel it has a bit of both. You know, there are times where I have to stick to what exactly what Dinuk wants, because, you know, everything else is so tight around it that if I, hopefully not, miss even one beat, everything can be thrown out. But at the same time, there are times where I have the freedom within what he has written to actually make it mine. So I love that, the combination of both the worlds. Yeah, you'll hear that. Mm.
This is maybe you say I think too much, but this is a question I've been wondering actually for years about hybrid compositions. So pieces that draw together at least two different musical traditions. Do you feel that, and this is a question anybody can answer, that this helps sort of increase cultural understanding between different cultural groups, or perhaps on the other hand, does it sort of contribute to the homogenization of the global village? So we're all sort of, our cultures are all sort of becoming one in a way as technology increases and the world becomes smaller. So how do you feel that a composition like this, or much of the work that the Silk Road Ensemble does, mm-hmm. you know, bridging all over the different cultures, what is the end result?
Do you want to give Yo-Yo's answer?
Uh-oh.
You go ahead.
No.
We're on air, so only if it's appropriate.
Well, he has a lot of fun, you know.
I know.
It's somewhere along the lines of when you know someone else's culture, when you put yourself in someone else's shoes, it informs your own. And that makes you a deeper, a richer person, a musician, a citizen, a community member. You're able to simply play a more vital, vibrant, important role in your life, which of course affects other people too. So I think this is something that is happening. It's happened more and more and more with the digital age and the internet age. And it's I don't see any sign of it stopping. And I see the walls, the barriers, the world getting smaller and smaller. Things getting broken down. Is that what he would say roughly?
Well, also, you know, also what I feel, if I take my individual life, I came out of India as a very proud Indian classical musician. But, you know, somebody asked me either in your class or the class before that I did, day before yesterday, that do you lose something when you collaborate? I feel you lose something to gain a lot more. Mm. And so I have gone from just being an Indian classical musician to having lost that sense that I'm an Indian classical musician, but in a way I have gone back to value my culture more, because I feel nothing that I grew up with, thinking that this is only mine, is actually only mine. It's a shared heritage, whether we know about it or not, whether we care about it or not, whether we accept it or not, our paths have crossed. So I have gone back, if you draw a zero, I have gone back to valuing my culture even more, because I feel I'm now taking care of it not only for myself, but for all of you. Mm-hmm. So by playing with an orchestra or playing with a string quartet or with playing with musicians from Azerbaijan or China, initially we don't even know one another's language. You know, how am I going to communicate? How am I going to communicate with Alistair with a piece that's written for an orchestra? But very slowly, when you are able to take that risk, you realize that it's immaterial, you know one another's culture or not. Take your instruments out, reach out, give a hug, everything falls in place. And to going back to what Alistair said, you value your culture, your music, from the eyes of everybody else. And so I value it more, and I'm probably now more consciously preserving it and doing whatever I can, because I'm doing it for everybody else.
Think about that, the idea of, you know, you hear very often music is a universal language, and you know, when you think about that, it seems like some musics are universal. They're referring to certain musics when they say that, like for example, perhaps the reference isn't a 10-hour piece by a Javanese gamelan. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a shorter, you know, maybe it's a piece of classical music or a piece of pop music. So how does that phrase sit with you that we hear so often, music is a universal language?
Can I answer that
quickly,
and then all of
I
you.
Know.
I was once asked by Yo-Yo to join and play with the CSO, Chicago Symphony Orchestra, during a concert. I was in the audience, enjoying the concert.
Yes. You, get up here.
Interval. Post-interval, they come out on stage, and I'm still enjoying the concert. And suddenly, I see Yo-Yo standing up, and he says to all these 3,000 or whatever the capacity, it's always sold out when you have that name associated with anything. He looks at the audience, and he says, how many of you want to experiment or enjoy something that no one has done before? So, of course, everybody said yes. Till then, I had no clue that it's going to be me. I'm going to be the guinea pig. You know, and then he suddenly says, Sandeep, I know you are here somewhere. So now I start shivering, my knees start. And he says, and I also know your top, because we were playing alternate nights. You know, we had a series that we were there for a year almost. And so he knew that my tablas are also there backstage somewhere. I wasn't in my concert clothes. He says, why don't you come on stage and play with us? And he looked at the maestro and he says, is it all right? And you know, who says no to Yo-Yo Ma? So it's like, yeah. He says, well, I don't think this piece was ever written for tabla. Sandeep, will you play with us on the Brandenburg Concerto? Till then, I had seen the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. That's it. So I was like, Yo-Yo, don't do this, Yo-Yo. I'm almost from the wings. I'm like, I know you are mad, but not to this extent, you know. I was like, oh, he's there, he's signaling, he's coming, you know. And there I was on stage with the CSO playing a piece of music that I had not even heard, forget who composed it, nothing, no clue. Yet when I joined and played it, I felt that I have played it forever in my life. So and also with certain music that I would turn it off. Honestly speaking, I would turn Western classical music playing in hotel rooms off. But now I can actually pinpoint a certain pieces like, oh, that's that piece. And I can also somewhat differentiate between a good orchestra and an average orchestra and a very good orchestra. So I find there is something in every music that I can connect to. So to me, I have now played with, you know, jazz musicians, classical musicians, string. I find communication very easy. I find something that I always know, maybe not the entirety, but the more I hear it, maybe not the first time, the fifth time, the seventh time, I almost think I know that piece. So to me, it's a very universal language. And the fact that there are these people from such different, supposedly different cultures getting together on stage and doing something and having so much fun in itself is the biggest proof that languages, cultures, religion, color really don't matter. That's my part, but I would love to hear from the two of you.
I don't think I could top that, really. But I believe in everything he just said. And I think it, you know, there's a tendency in our society to put things in a box and compartmentalize things. You know, so, you know, even sort of the last big Hollywood blockbuster is trying to be just like the previous blockbuster, but only just a little bit different so that it can sell, you know, it still draw a different audience. And
is that Hollywood or Bollywood?
I don't know, both. You know,
are they different?
And I think that's a shame because, you know, it's not what art is about, because art has that universality and gesture communicates, you know, in a very fundamental, universal way. What do you think? I would love to hear Alistair actually speak about, just because, you know, there are very few conductors at his level, at the highest level, who have experience with those kind of global pieces, you know, there is a, you know, not only is his programming eclectic and diverse, which is the kind of programming I love, where you've got Beethoven next to, you know, mm-hmm. like say a Pipa concerto or something. Mm-hmm. But I know you also have the experience of conducting a lot of Silk Road type pieces, mm-hmm. And the core repertoire. What kind of perspective that does that? How much do you enjoy that very much? The shuttling back and forth between these things, or do you just see them as one big entity?
I'm beginning to see them as one big entity.
Right.
At first, it was managers and when I was with the Seattle Symphony, the staff, they said, don't say no to anything. Mm-hmm. If someone asks you to go to do a pops concert, do it. If someone asks you to go do a new music concert, do it. A Baroque concert or a huge orchestra, go do it. But I feel that my work with the Silk Road, and go with me for a second, this couldn't be a bit weird, has given me a unique opportunity. The Silk Road hasn't worked with many conductors. Mm-hmm. And I was on tour with Sandeep and the Silk Road in Japan a few years ago, and sitting next to me at the dinner was one of the tech guys, Aaron. Amazing lighting and sound, man. And he said, "So do you like conducting the Silk Road?" And I'm like, "Am I being recorded? What is this trick question?" I mean, I go, "Yeah, why would you ask that?" And he says, "Well, you know, we've seen a few conductors, but you keep coming back." I said, "Well, I keep getting invited back." He said, "Yeah, but it takes a special kind of conductor to conduct this group." And I said, "Oh, what do you mean?" And if you think about what a conductor does, someone has to take charge, or else you have 100 or 50 different opinions there. You have to drive that GPS. And with an ensemble like the Silk Road, where it's full of the top, the cream of the cream individuals who have conductor-like personalities, you can't get a conductor going in there and telling the Silk Road what to do. Mm-hmm. And a lot of conductors have failed before I came along and doing that. And I guess, you know, thanks to Yo, he took me aside once. He said, "You know, we do rehearsals and you'll start it, but if we stop, allow people to talk." It's kind of like the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra mm-hmm. in New York, where there is no conductor, and rehearsals take forever because everybody can say, "Well, I think it should be softer, I think it should be longer, I think it should be off the string, I think it should be the sound," and so everybody gets an idea. It takes time, but you get a really deep product. So I learned to be what I call, this is where you need to go with me, a chamber conductor. Now, a conductor needs to lead. A conductor, you think of a big ensemble, but a chamber conductor, someone who's making music with them, is embracing other opinions. This is not normal, really, because, you know, we're under the gun. We've got a certain rehearsal. We've got to get to it. We've got to go for it. The rehearsal's a little bit more flexible with the Silk Road Ensemble because there are fewer players. They're not members of unions or whatever, and we can have the rehearsal. We have more time to... And so when the violinist or the violist will have given a great idea, we all want to try, you know, they'll look to me, "You have any ideas, Alistair?" And I just feel like I'm contributing. I'm one of the team.
And you're sort of facilitating. Also
I have to facilitate because it's so difficult a piece that we don't know where to go. But I feel that being a chamber conductor there has helped my work as being a symphony conductor, where I really do need to make sure we're all on time and we're being more efficient. So it all melds into one. I heard the wrong advice on tour. We did this piece in Japan. One of our members of the ensemble is American-Japanese, and we'd done it in America, and it had narration, and he had narrated it in English, but of course he's now narrating it in Japanese for the Japanese public, and I had to write all the phonetics in my score. I had to know what I'm listening for. I don't speak Japanese. To catch that, we're going to continue on. It was a real challenge. It was great. But the musicians, the ensemble, we'd forgotten the stories of these incredible parables. It was called Paths of Parables by Dmitry Yanovinovsky, who's going to be composing a piece for us, our chamber orchestra, in March. And so when we did it in England, in English, if you think in Chicago as well, we could hear the English narration and we knew what all of our little nuances meant and went in with the words. Of course, we had no idea where it fit with the Japanese. So the advice from some of the tech people were, we need to sell it more. We can't remember what the stories are. The audience knows. And so I took that to mean, I can act it out a bit more as conductor. I can be a bit bigger. I can be a bit, bring the attention to me. Oh, that happened for one concert only. Yo-Yo took me in the next day. He said, you know, we love having you here at the Silk Road. And about how you conducted last night. It's like, oh. So he turned a conducting lesson into a life lesson for me and gave me more grounding, gave me more understanding that really to be quiet, to be invisible, to be small, to let the musicians tell the story, so to speak. That was what I needed at the time, and I've translated that into my work with symphony orchestras, with Western orchestras, and
it draws the audience in rather than pushes it out to them. Kind of.
I remember Barenboim with the Staatsoper orchestra in Berlin. They did Till Eulenspiegel by Strauss, one of my favorite pieces. And at the very end, you hear ba bam chim bam chim, and the E flat kind of diddle ba ba bam ba bam chim bam. And Barenboim there is conducting. They had two performances of it. I went to the first and the second. Ba bam chim bam chim ba bam chim. He missed his cue. And so it was one of those unfortunate things. He's a great player. We forgive him. But they had a sound check the next night in a different hall. I went to it. And he rehearsed a little bit and then says, anybody want? And the E-flat clarinet player said, can you give me a cue at that time? And he says, why? He says, if I point at you, people are looking at me. Whereas if you play, we're listening and listening to you. That little comment there. I try to be as invisible as I can. I don't have... People often say, you know, we enjoyed listening to the music almost as much as we enjoyed watching you conduct. And this comment doesn't feel good with me. And I prefer that we all enjoyed listening to the music because that's what we're there for. Or watching the soloist, that's what we're there for. But I find that if I can feel as invisible as possible and let the music sound, of course I've got to do my job and help things, but I feel I am changing ever. I'm not as big as I used to be. When I conduct, if you think I'm big now, you ain't seen nothing yet. And I'm just trying to focus my own actions and my own movements into helping the music come through, mm-hmm. whatever ensemble I'm with. Mm-hmm.
So you won't be wearing your fluorescent tux?
No. Sandeep has resized it for me.
Okay.
Well, Leonard Bernstein once said, in order to achieve great things, you need a plan and not quite enough time. Right? So
yes.
We are... nearing the end of our hour, and I thought it might be nice if you're up for it, if you wanted to maybe play.
Let me play something.
Do we have to clap again?
I like it if you clap.
Okay.
You know, in India, they clap throughout the concert, and so again, the different experience when I first started playing solos outside of India, nobody claps. You know, so, because in a tabla recital, you don't play, you play for an hour or so, but the pieces, you know, you stop and people clap and then you announce another piece. And so there's clapping throughout, and especially the first piece, you start with the first piece, it ends, and there should be thunderous applause.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am, I don't remember which city I played, expecting the same, you know, and nothing. So throughout the concert, I kept working harder, and I'm like, oh my god, I am the worst tabla player in the history of this drum, or there's something wrong with the audience. And when I ended, I got a standing ovation, and I remember that moment, and I was like, where were all of you? So not for the orchestra concert, but now you can clap. Let me play a fixed composition, you know, the one that I played for you was the only, like, the 5% of it was fixed, but tabla repertoire is incredible. We have compositions of various kinds that are also fixed, like, from start to end, you cannot do anything. That's the GPS. How you play it is how you drive your car, right? So I'll vocalize this composition for you. It's called the Punjabi Gut. See, again, you don't have to know it. Just you'll feel the beauty in it as I vocalize it. So da gina ga takita gina ga da tika dikita kata ga diga na nagina nagina takita gina ga da tika dikita kata ga diga na ta kena ka takita kena ka ta tika dikita kata ga diga na nagina nagina takita gina ga da tika dikita kata ga diga da kena ka dina takita kena ka dina da tika dikita kata kata ga diga na ta nagina nagina gina takita gina ka dina da tika dikita kata kata ga diga na ta ta kena ka dina takita kena ka dina da tika dikita kata kata ga diga na ta nagina nagina gina takita gina ka dina da tika That's one composition, so I'll play that for you.
So much. We have been speaking with Sandeep Das, virtuoso tabla player, Dinuk Wadiratne, composer and music director and conductor of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, Alistair Willis. Thank you very much. A big round of applause. This was wonderful.
Thank you.